into streaming, so I'd love to know what that side of the world looks like. But for me, streaming is only IG Live for now.
I mean, I think for somebody like you, whose content is not necessarily, you know, with notes and with a lot of cuts and with a lot of editing, just live streams are so much better. You just go online, speak your heart out, which is what people want to listen to, particularly if you're offering them any sort of life advice, financial advice. They want it to be raw. They don't want it to be manicured. They're so sick of the volume of manicured, you know, sculpted advice that seems like the truth, but is not really. I think live streams, especially on Sundays, you just have like a cup of coffee with you, sit down. People will love it, man.
And do you find that helping in the engagement?
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
See, it's about the primarily what happens at this level of competition in a market space is that people need additional incentive. You understand that this better than I do, right? And the additional incentive with live stream is participation. The audience feels like it's contributing. And when it feels like it's contributing, they're like, also there is this element of unexpectedness. Because this could go anywhere. This has not gone through the editing filter. And so people love it.
Yeah. The only thing that I don't like about the YouTube live and streaming in general is that you can't bring on participants live.
Oh, yeah. That's difficult.
Yeah. That just sucks. Because for me, I wouldn't want to hear my own self for an hour. So I don't know about people. So it's like...
Silently cries in a corner.
Exactly. And then with like, you know, chat, text, padna, so then it just sounds like a webinar of sorts. And but I should give it a shot. So we internally decided that when I hit 200K is when we'll do our first YouTube live. Let's see how that goes.
Is V like a team? Do you operate on that scale where you have a team?
I have a 10-member team. Yeah.
Yeah, that's fantastic. How long have you been YouTubing?
YouTube is early, man. YouTube is 2017 is when I started, but I really doubled down on it 5 months back.
Oh, right.
Very early. So my platform was LinkedIn. Mm-hmm. My platform for the longest time was just LinkedIn. So that's where I have about 1 million subs. But everything else is fairly recent in the last 3 to 4 years itself. Uh-huh. But I like playing creativity as a process game. So I don't like creativity to be this... किसी दिन फूक के कुछ बहुत उजाला सा निकलेगा तुम्हारी जिंदगी से ऐसे समथिंग लाइक दैट इट्स लाइक अ क्लिनिकल प्रोसेस सो दैट्स हाउ आई ऑपरेट माय सेल्फ
सो लाइक एन इंक्रीमेंटल
एवरीथिंग इज ऑर्केस्ट्रेटेड हां सो एवरी डे इज लाइक क्लिनिकली एवरी डे कंटेंट नीड्स टू शिप आउट ऑन ऑल प्लेटफॉर्म्स इन व्हाटएवर मैनर्स इट इज एंड अपील टू द टीजी ऑन दैट प्लेटफॉर्म इन कॉन्टेक्स्ट इन स्पिरिट in even visuals. And that's what the team helps me to do. So I am the content creator and I am the one who just gets everything. And after that, they just take over and then just cut, and ship
it out. I have
an
insane amount of questions already.
Oh,
so
perfect. We will make that happen.
No, because this is what I was going to ask you, right? Moving from LinkedIn to YouTube is moving between massive mindsets as far as the TG is concerned. The target audience is absolutely different, right? Okay. You were speaking in a more, say, mature, in a more articulate fashion on LinkedIn, and that's incentivized and rewarded. While on the other hand, you have to sort of, like I found, I have to control myself on YouTube. I cannot fly off the handle. I have to really stick to it. It's like a tightrope walking seminar for me. Does that not bother you doing it in the same day? Like that's a lot of interchangeability.
So the context switching is something that entrepreneurship in general just teaches you a lot. And I think I've gotten good at it. The way that I think about this, Prakhar, is the machinery is set in such a way where I'm creating content specifically for a platform and I'm in that zone because I don't do streaming as you. So my content is produced much in advance. We have a 2-week cycle. So every Tuesday is when I dedicate the last half of the day towards just creating content for YouTube. And I will, like, I technically work for only 3 hours a week creating content. And those 1.5 hour of footage is just converted into then 68 different forms of content pieces that goes across 5 platforms across the entire week. And there are then pieces and nuggets that come along. So LinkedIn, for instance, I was big on LinkedIn video, which is where I think most of my, I'd say, competitive edge came from, because it was fresh. It was a new product. No one was focusing on it. No one believed in it. But I think some product manager's KPI at LinkedIn was to make video work. And I think he used me or she used me as a guinea pig, and I was more than happy to. To 2016, when they launched, I was one of the early adopters in India of LinkedIn video. Mm. And phir Bariku Wednesdays as a product came about, which is very, every Wednesday I used to ship out a video. And this was my experiences of being an entrepreneur. What's going on? What do I have to learn? What do I have to share?
Hmm.
And LinkedIn just kept pushing it because they're like, yeah, acha content hai, shayad acha content hai, log isse engage kar rahe hain. And that gave me the jump early on. But now LinkedIn video is not working anymore. Yeah, it is, right? So now it's surprisingly gone back to text.
Huh.
So I also moved to text. So now you'll see most of my posts are just text.
Right.
While YouTube is just that video game. And as I said, I started that journey aggressively only about 5 months back while I was putting out videos. But I was doing it like someone who didn't know any better.
Hmm.
So I was frankly a rookie, didn't understand the science behind it, didn't understand the algorithm behind it. Last 5 months, we devoted ourselves and said, no, let's make a separate team. Let's just focus our energies on it. And let's just understand all that there is to understand about YouTube. And it's thankfully yielding results.
Yeah.
But every platform, different approach, different content, different target audience. And I like that.
No, I mean, that sounds like that adds width to my idea of you quite instantly, right? Because all I've seen is Twitter. I'm not on LinkedIn. I've spared myself the horror of entering the biggest circle jerk the world has ever seen. So I haven't yet gotten myself on LinkedIn, but Twitter comes close. Twitter's like that very often. And I'm on YouTube. So I've seen you there. I've seen you on Instagram. I haven't seen you on LinkedIn. And the question that comes to me almost immediately, because this is something that I've been thinking about personally for a very long time, right? I understand, I turned 25 day before. So I understand what a 25-year-old Yay! Thinks like. What a 25-year-old
Happy belated birthday.
Thank you. But there's a point to this. I understood what a 25-year-old feels like only day before. If I see it empirically, that's what I understand. I understand the first 25 years of life. I don't understand the next 10 or the next 20. Right? I'm assuming you're slightly older than I am.
I'm 40.
You're 40. So you're 15 years older than I am, right? And you understand what a 35-year-old probably has as an issue. Maybe even 45. I don't know how the range works around that age. Sure. And I always wonder, if I had to create content for ladies and gentlemen of that particular age, how is it different from creating content for, say, a 24-year-old? Like, what are the problems or what are the obstacles that they go through? Which is, how does life change in the next 10 years is probably what I'm trying to get at.
It's a fascinating question, yeah. And frankly, my job was easier when I started creating content because it was LinkedIn and I was in the vicinity of the target audience because I was 35 when I started creating content on LinkedIn and most of the people on LinkedIn are about 30, 35. So it wasn't that far away. And because I was an entrepreneur and a startup guy or a founder, there was a lot that I had to share and the ones who were resonating with it were also similar audiences. But when I changed the game and then jumped to Instagram and then YouTube, Twitter is still, I'd say, LinkedIn-ish, but in a slightly different genre. But YouTube and Instagram specifically, it stretched me to an extent that I haven't been in the last 5 years or so. Because now suddenly I was like, I don't know who I should be speaking to. And it's clear that the data suggests the bulk of it is 18 to 24. But I have nothing to tell 18 to 24-year-olds. So I first have to figure out what is it that they care to know about and what is it that they genuinely care about and perhaps need any guidance around.
Right.
And so I had to first create a persona of who am I and in what capacity can I help? So do I be the aggressive guy who is saying, yeah, bro, like Gary Vee, just do this shit and just figure it? Or do I want to be the condescending guy who's just bringing people down and making fun of them? Or do I want to be the entertainer who's like, hey, my life is so cool, but I'm like a failure? Or do I want to be a teacher or a guide telling them, yeah, here are the things that I did, here are the places where I fucked up, and this is what you can learn?
Right.
And I figured that the role that I want to play is definitely of the instructor, the teacher, the guide, because that's something that I like playing and I feel that I can add value. But I didn't know what to instruct. I didn't know what to guide on. I didn't know what are the lessons that people care to know about. So I had to just go deep into that and spend a lot of time just interacting with people. So my Instagram DMs, there was a time when I was reading all of them, responding to them, asking them questions. What are the things that you care about? Kaun-kaun si mushkilein hain zindagi mein? And everything boiled down to the same things. So I figured that things weren't very different from when I was in my 20s the complexity and the nature of problems had changed, but the problem per se had remained the same. So it was still about, don't know how to manage my parents, don't know how to manage my career, don't know how to manage my money. And these three things were the same at my end as well. But the nature and the complexity, as I said, had completely altered, just absolutely fundamentally shifted. So I had to speak to them in a way that I did not know. Hmm. And I think I prepared for that. And that helped me a lot. Today, I would argue that by design, I don't spend a lot of time in the cocoon or the ecosystem I used to belong to 5 years back. Like I hardly interact with founders and startup guys. I hardly read their news. I'm just in touch with a few that I admire and respect, but that's pretty much it. I'm spending 70% of my time with 18 to 24 year olds who are just mesmerizing me with what they're going through.
Right.
And I'm just trying to see if I can in any way help.
Right. It would appear that we are probably on the opposite shores of the same river where, like I said, I understand what a 25 year old is going through. I can tell you, you're right. It's how do I manage my relationships primarily? Because with parents, how do I tell them I want to do X when they want me to do Y? Right? It's either girlfriend, boyfriend stuff that at least comes up to me. I don't know if it comes up to you. Then there is, how do I make money? Because I want to be financially independent and secure going into the future, right? There is uncertainty that comes with money like no other place. And then finally, how do I manage my career? How do I look at the next 30, 40 years of doing things? Right? And it's that's the set of questions. Is it the same kind of sort of with a slight variation for somebody between 35 and 40, or do the nature of the questions change? Does the girlfriend, boyfriend, father, mother become child, children, son, daughter, and wife, husband? Or like, how does it work?
I think it changes, but the mix of these three things is what changes. Yeah. I don't think that the three things per se change. So I'd say if I were to hazard a guess that 18 to 24, you would have about 40% of your time devoted towards making money and 40% towards career and about 20% towards relationships. When you get to the 35 to 45, I'd argue it will be about 30% making money, about 40% relationships, and then about 30% career. So relationships become important only because you realize the value of them, and you realize, or perhaps you realize how much you suck at them.
Right.
And either way, you just figure that boss, paise se kuch hone nahi wala. Zaruri hai, but it's not that this will make me happy.
Sure.
And beyond a point.
So like that begins to dawn, huh? Around that time.
It begins to dawn. And unfortunately, I wouldn't say unfortunately, but the reality is it begins to dawn because most people realize the absence of it as against realize the abundance of it. So they're like, fuck, I have horrible relationships, or I don't have relationships. And that's why I'm realizing that that's not a pretty place to be in.
That's very interesting. I'm going to probably go up on LinkedIn and look up all your posts that you've written to the target audience to better understand. But I like one of the other things along the same lines of thinking is that I can do what I do because I relate to my audience. It's almost like there are unsaid assumptions in my content, right? Say if I'm tackling the problem of motivation, I'm tackling it from an end of what is the solution to this problem, hypothetically, sure. Right? And it's because the assumption in there is that you who's listening do not really know where to get motivated from. Right. And it's because I went through the same process myself when I was growing up. When I was 18, 19, it was difficult for me to get out of bed or do X or do Y or commit myself or so on and so forth. Yeah. And I wonder if it's similarly for you that, you know, this rather romantic adage that we go back to our past to heal the wounds or like give ourselves what we did not have in terms of creating content. I wonder if most people who create content like the way you and I do, which is helpful content, which is offering guidance, advice, whatever, is of that nature. Am I correct in that guess, or am I far off?
No, I don't think it's a question of being correct or far off. I genuinely feel that it's just a vantage point from where one's coming. Where I come from, Prakhar, as an entrepreneur, I've been trained, and this is one of the biggest mistakes that I see entrepreneurs making, and I was guilty of it early on as well, that we tend to think that we are the customer, and we tend to think that we manifest the customer in the most perfect manner. Mm. And more often than not, that's far away from the truth. We're not right. The customer. We're nowhere close to representing the customer or personifying them. And I think that training helped me because when I began to think of, all right, if I have to create content that helps others, I cannot be thinking of what were the challenges in my life. I'm not the customer. I can't begin by saying, here's how I solved it. So here's how I think everyone should be solving it. It's more about, okay, let's just, I am a problem solver. So my superpower, I mean, I say, I don't mean me, but the creator should think like, here is my superpower. My superpower is I'm able to simplify things. I'm able to create a hook or some sort of an excitement or some sort of a resonance with the audience. Or I'm able to just bring in the best people and have conversations which bring out the best. That's my superpower. But I'm not going to assume that my superpower is how I live my life.
Mm.
Because that's just my life. That doesn't and will not be someone else's life. So I'm going to stick to my superpower and then go and apply this to whatever dimension I can. And if, like, I believe my expertise lies in simplifying things and not assuming. Hmm. That's just where I come from. So if I'm creating a video on personal finance and I'm talking about, hey, this is how inflation destroys your investments when it's compounding, I'm not going to assume that they understand what inflation is, what compounding is, what investments is. I will be like, okay, let me tell you first, what is inflation? Let me tell you first, what is compounding? And that may mean that an audience which is in my age group will be like, kya baate kar rahe? Like, why does he need to be spending time with that?
Right.
So and this is something that I've seen. I have, through the journey of my content creation, actually ended up alienating a lot of friends from my age group because they're like, we don't get you anymore.
Right.
Like, we don't understand why you're talking about ABCD when we shouldn't be talking about complex things.
Hmm.
But that's just the choice I make. And because of that, the other obvious choice just becomes a choice.
It's weird like that. I went through it myself. Initially, when I started putting out content, people were like, what? Why are you doing this? Right?
Yeah.
And then eventually I saw a lot of them turn because they were like, bro, that's good content. Within a span of a few months, and I was like, achha, theek hai, logo ka opinion is unstable beyond reality. Like, it's made to be unstable. I cannot stick to what people are saying at all. And it's also like I cannot imagine a friend of mine. Like, friends will come and then they'll ask for help or I'll offer advice or whatnot. But for them to entertain me for an hour and a half long live stream, I cannot imagine. Right. It's not just me who's not the consumer. My friends are also not the consumers of my content. I kind of think of it like that. But you know why I wondered about you probably going through something similar is because I was, I think, listening to you on Tanmay and you were talking about being at ISB. And what that made me feel was at least you were in a place where you got, say, resources, access, knowledge, whatever company network that was, the 1% of the 1% in terms of understanding management, for that matter, right? Like, it's one of the best schools in India, right? And so, the best, yeah, probably. Is this ISB Hyderabad or is this the other one?
There was no other one. There was just Hyderabad at back then.
This guy's like, listen, there was only one, okay? Don't give me this two wala bullshit.
Very nice.
How is it, man? How is going to ISB? I genuinely think educational institutes are the eighth wonder. All educational institutes. Like, I think it's fantastic ki hum ek group of monkeys ko bolte hain, suno, tum log na padhai karo, hum baaki sab dekh rahe hain. Tum seekh lo, theek hai, right? Don't be worried about the world. Just focus on this. I think it's amazing as an invention. So,
yeah.
For ISB, how's ISB like?
It was game-changing for me. Yeah. It was absolutely game-changing for me. So I went to ISB at the age of 25, just when, at your age. But my journey was very different because at the age of 24, I'd come out of this horrible relationship with what I thought I would be doing in life.
Hmm.
I was in the US doing my PhD, and that's all that I wanted to do for the longest time that I know myself.
What PhD was this? What is it in?
In physics.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, cool. I was training to be an astrophysicist and actually joined NASA.
Oh, very cool.
And everything that I was doing in life was just centered around that. But when I landed up in the US, I spent 2 years there. I realized it wasn't for me. I had changed and my understanding of what I was meant to do for the rest of my life had also become better. And clearly there was a mismatch. And I don't know where I got that moral courage from, but I'm glad I did. I just decided to drop out of my PhD and come back to India, much to the dismay of everyone around.
For sure.
Everyone. So at the age of 24, I came back to India. No plan, no goal, no direction, no money, nothing whatsoever. And I had to restart my life. And my friends were like, look, you're confused. So why don't you do what most confused people do? Go get an MBA.
Just an MBA. It's way worse, huh?
So And I didn't want to spend 2 years, frankly, the time, the money, the investment in again, going through something which I wasn't sure how it would help me.
For sure.
I just, as I said, come back from a broken relationship. So I didn't want this to be the rebound. So I serendipitously came across ISB. And what I loved about it was the 1 year school. Hmm. So it was great. I wouldn't have to spend 2 years. But more than that, the fact that this was a bunch of work experience people who would come together and study with me.
Hmm.
And back then, if you asked me who were the most important men and women in the world, my limited mind and worldview would say Madame Curie, Albert Einstein, Archimedes, Newton. I had no idea about the real world. I had zero idea about sales, marketing, IT, operations, supply chain. So for me to spend time with people who had actually done that shit in real life would be just the perfect learning platform. So I think I went to ISB as such a novice, as such a guy who had nothing to offer but all to absorb, that it was just fundamentally life-altering for me. And I think that's what worked. That's just what worked.
Imagine finding yourself, like, I have often felt like being the dumbest person in the room is such an advantage. Because you don't have any burden to speak and you can learn everything. Correct.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
It's very difficult initially to sit with that because you're like, I want to contribute or whatever your instinct might be, but it's such a blessing in that sense. But confirm my hypothesis for me. I feel like with educational institutes, it's almost never about anything else except the company. Like, you can give me the best professor, but if there is no friction from people around me in terms of working towards an idea or working towards a concept or working towards a project or whatever, it's probably not going to happen. Like, it's the culture, the negative spaces. Once the professor's absent, what am I talking about with my peer is what determines what I'm truly learning. And I found that it's almost invaluable. I paused my college instantly after COVID was announced. I was like, I'm not going to go to school now. I'm not going to do it over Zoom. I have to be around those people to actually feel the heat. Is that true? Do you feel similarly?
100%. 100%. One of my favorite interview questions, Prakar, is, do you think that the course is more important or the institute?
Hmm.
And invariably, almost everyone says the course is more important. And like, you will only realize after 10 years that it's not. It's the institute that is important, because I would much rather do the shittiest course from the best college than do the best course from the shittiest college.
Hmm.
Everything is determined by the company. And you so rightly pointed that out. I went to North Campus Hindu College, and just the fact that I was surrounded by colleges and all of those had in some way gotten far ahead in life, at least academically, at least on paper. Kuch to mag-mag ke unhone CBSE mein crack machaya tha. But at least the conversations were somewhat superior to what it would have been if I, say, went to a private college and even if it was an engineering degree and so on.
Mm.
And that was the same with ISB. That was the same with the company that I joined thereafter. It's such a fundamental attribute that most people miss out on.
Mm.
And it's not just school or college. It is generally life. Like when people say that you are the outcome of the five people you spend the most time with, that's not just some random motivational garbage. It actually is true.
Mm-hmm.
It is true,
right?
Because I've created this circle, and the circle is, I think of life either in 2x2 matrices or in a flywheel.
Mm-hmm.
And everything that I think in life has to fit in into these two. Otherwise there's something wrong.
Hmm.
And the flywheel that I think of in life is that the people that you spend time with are the stories that you hear. The stories that you hear are the thoughts that you have. The thoughts that you have are the actions that you take. And the actions that you take are the people that you spend time with.
Hmm.
And that is at least life's flywheel for me.
Sure.
Which means this is a circle that you can't break. So if you're still hanging out with your school friends, and nothing wrong with that, but if you still are, you still are.
Right.
And that's a very important recognition to have, that you are still... Exactly.
Right.
It has. Which which we don't think of, because we're like, oh, no, dost hote hain, har ek dost zaruri hota hai. But no, that's at least not true.
Right. I'm also fond of the romantic attitude we have towards friendship in India. Like, living in America made me realize, wahan to koi dosti ka concept hi nahi hai. Yahan to bro, like, you know. So there is that to it. But you're right. It's absolutely true. It's not just almost all the ideas, all the strivings, all the drives that you have, all the motivations that you have come from people around you. And you see it very quickly. If you change cities and meet a new friend group, you'll see how quickly your personality overall changes. Right? And at that point, you'll be like, I want to optimize this. I want to be around people that are driven. Or at least I want to create a culture where people are moving towards something, especially if you're my age, like, you know, it's a fairly young age. But settle this for me, since you've been to Delhi University, you've been to ISB, you've been to an American, unnamed American university. I don't know which one that is.
And Michigan State.
Michigan State. Michigan State's great, no?
It is. Well, right. for what I was doing, it was.
And you've done the, you know, the antithesis, the Thanos to the college experience, which is entrepreneurship. There is this constant debate, right? It's been going on for 20 years now. I know Peter Thiel's on the other side. I know James Altucher is on the other side. I know in India, say, or even Elon Musk is on the other side. In India, Varun Maya was taking the flag of it very, right? That colleges are almost becoming redundant, particularly management colleges. Instead, do entrepreneurship. For somebody who's eaten the pie on both sides, what's your verdict? Or do you... Or
think
inkling?
I'd agree with that. I 100% agree with them. I think colleges are great for people to discover themselves and use it only for that purpose. Don't use it to get a job. Don't use it to learn anything, because frankly, none of these things are going to be as well optimized as you might think they are. But if you don't go to college, that doesn't set you up for failure in life. At least not in the way that you would want to believe. So entrepreneurship is a great leveler. What I love about entrepreneurship is that it's the most democratic way of thinking about things, where we don't buy stuff from startups because their founder is from a certain school. We don't buy it because they've raised a certain money. We don't buy it because they scored these many marks in their college. We don't buy it if they've gone through a divorce. We couldn't care less. Like, two fucks given to the background of the founder. What we care about is that they make a product that we love and we are willing to use and pay money for. If yes, great, join the party. If not, sorry, try again or try harder. And that's something that is fascinating. It's democratic in a way that very few things are. And you could, it's like sports. And we saw yesterday at the IPL auction that the son of possibly the greatest cricketer in the world got sold for what I would say is peanuts. And it's only because he didn't inherit any of what the greatest cricketer in the world has. He has to still slog it out and build it on his own. And I love that about it. But that's not true for business. It's not true for politics. It's not true for several other things. So I think that entrepreneurship teaches you a lot. And the value of you having gone through that grind is only going to increase in the next 10 to 20 years. Mm. I still wouldn't dismiss college because, as I said, it's a great way to discover yourself. Should that be the objective? Mm. If the objective is to get a job or to get a degree or to get a resume point, you most likely will be disappointed.
Tell me about self-discovery, because I also heard you mention entrepreneurship is great for self-discovery, right? What is self-discovery? How do I hold it in my hands as a concept? I don't understand what is self-discovery.
It is being acutely aware of what you're good at, what you're not good at, and why you behave or react to ABC, XYZ things, or what's the basis of your reactions. And I would limit just to that. So a self-aware individual, in my opinion, is someone who understands their blind spots and also understands why they react to whatever is it that they react to. And why? It's not so much about controlling. So it's not to be a stoic. It's not to be, oh, I'm Zen-like and I'm not going to be reacting to anything in life. It is about, I know I'm angry and I also know why I'm angry. I know I'm jealous, but I also know that I'm jealous. And I know why I'm jealous. I know that I suck at managing people and I know why I suck at managing people. And that level of self-awareness is very rare, because most people, one, hold other people's opinion about themselves in far higher regard than they ever probe their own self-discovery path. And two, we don't want to have uncomfortable conversations with our own selves. We just don't. We're scared of them. It makes us anxious. It's in some way fed to us that we shouldn't be doing anything that is negative or that's pessimistic. But we err on the line of what is self-awareness and what is badgering your own self. Hmm. And I think most people think that self-awareness is about tumme ye khot hai, tumme ye galat hai, tumme ye kami hai, and then that will take you to a negative path.
I think this whole negative self-talk thing is so interesting because I don't think it dies away. And I think the process of entering negative self-talk is so simple. I tell myself do X. I approach X. I end up doing Y instead. Now, I have two options. Either let myself go without consequence or give myself consequence. What is the consequence? Yeah. I'll punish myself. So yeah. The two parts of you, right? Like the two distinct, the watcher and the doer. The watcher now punishes the doer. It's like, kya karta hai tu, right? You're such a loser. Yeah. It keeps repeating over a period of time because you're trying to punish yourself. Over a long period of time, nothing changes as far as actions are concerned. Your self-esteem and your self-image go down the rabbit hole. And you're like, maine khud ko punish bhi kiya, to bhi koi outcome nahi aa raha, main aur loser hoon. Right? You treat yourself like cattle. It's unconsciously treating yourself like you are some donkey or tumhe carrots and sticks ki zarurat hai. Right? And if you just get... So that's how I would begin thinking about self-awareness, is the many different patterns I by default enter into.
Sure.
Because there's a lot of like default thinking that goes on. And... of course, like college, because it provides you with such an interesting insulated climate to sort of discover yourself without, say, a direct market incentive. Because it's not just that you're discovering yourself in terms of what a job demands of you or what the market demands of you. You're discovering yourself freely across dimensions. But with entrepreneurship or with, for that matter, self-ownership of any nature, where you are supposed to interact with the market and then you're supposed to make your returns. It's a whole different level of brutality. There is no comfort, right? There is no like cradling you, cajoling you, this, that. You either are or you are not. And it's a matter of skill and hard work that you find yourself. And I found that that is sort of like the great, like you said, the great leveler. It's also the great revealer.
Hmm.
It's like you're caught naked. You're the king and you're caught naked, right? And I don't know. If when I come to think of it, I cannot discount the value of either. They both belong in places. They both particularly, like you said, right? If you get into a great college, there is no way you should not go ahead and do that. There's True. Probably an experience of a lifetime waiting for you there. I found it myself. So that I agree with. But I was very skeptical of management colleges when I was a little kid. Like I was like, management kaise padha sakta hai koi? Like management is such an interpersonal dynamic. It's something that you learn in the body, not particularly say in the mind, right? And I was naive. I understand that. On the other hand of the same naive coin was I kept wondering if colleges teach leadership.
Mm.
Because when you're a kid, you think in very binary terms and those terms don't really map onto your adult reality. And so there is a leader and then there's people who follow the leader. And I was always up for being the leader, right? And even now, I've almost never come across a course that teaches leadership. And I've very rarely come across content that's centered around how to be a good leader. My first question along that line probably is going to be, do you even think that the ideal, or for that matter, the well-spoken form of leadership maps onto what is pragmatic, practical reality when it comes to entrepreneurship, or is it absolutely divorced?
No, I definitely wouldn't say it's divorced here. It's stemming from the same foundation, and much of the literature and much of practical life is also pretty much the same. But I think that the nature of this leadership is very different, and the kind of followers, if I may say so and use that word, is also going to be very different in a startup or an entrepreneurial environment as against a corporate or a process-driven environment. The kind of people that you would also chase would be very different. For instance, if you are a leader in a well-established company, let's say one of the big tech companies, your job is frankly not to challenge them, to motivate them, to drive them towards innovation and so on. Because all said and done, it's very fancy for one to think, innovation and yes, bahut zaruri hota hai. But in a company as big as Google or Facebook, which has more than 100,000 people working with it, no more than 1% truly drive the organization forward. Everyone else is just filling in a seat. They're smart, nonetheless. They're working on meaningful things, but it's not that they're creating massive changes, because 1% are just constantly pushing the company forward. Rest, everyone's just filling in a seat. And that means your job as a leader is to ensure that everyone just does their job in the best manner possible. Almost to the extent that you want them to be feeling stable, secure, comforted, and making sure that everything that they need to get the job done is well understood. And there's also immense clarity in their head of what is it that they need to do so that they do it well. But when you move to an uncertain environment such as a startup, you possibly would be the worst leader if this is how you lead, or that's your definition of leadership. Because what you want is, we're all going to embark on this journey and we have no idea where it's going to end up. But the only reason why we will hopefully end up in a better spot is that we don't give up. And that means, by definition, we don't know what is the playbook. There is no rule book. There is no prescription of what is expected from you. There is no KPI, KRA that I can define for you. And you still have to show up every single day, even when things are tough. So my job as a leader is to constantly keep reminding you of why we are in it. Why this is meaningful and purposeful for each one of us, including you, me, and everyone else around it. And that's a very different kind of leadership. So I feel that leadership has its own skins, and the troubles when you see startups, when they become big and when they become unicorns, then hiring executives from top companies and still not being able to make it work is because they are for decades used to a certain kind of leadership that still has not manifested itself in this culture, because the startup's just grown to become a unicorn, but on a very different principle. And that's where the friction arises of what is leadership and whether that even applies or not. But I think the foundations remain the same. The nature of it differs.
You think there is like a, you know, they say peacetime generals, wartime generals in the army. Is it like that with like leaders of organizations? Whereas if you're growing, you need a different kind of guy. And when you're stagnating, you need a different kind of guy.
Agree, yeah.
Yeah?
Agree, exactly. Though it's a simplistic way, because the world loves to have a zero or a one and a bit and bite approach to everything.
Right.
But if one had to have an approach, that a wartime and a peacetime general is a great way to think about it.
Very interesting. Very interesting. As far as startups are concerned, because startups started becoming like this, very like, you know, like, I don't think there is a problem where we don't glorify entrepreneurs. I think if you look at the right place, all we do is probably like this word founder is sort of synonymous with so many words history has held at such prestige, right? I think we do a decent enough job at glorifying founders. I think startups are extremely cool even now, and it's been 10 years. The guitar and stand-up comedy was cool for only 5, right? So I think we do a pretty decent job, but I still don't see startups at the scale. Like, I'm not denying they're growing, incremental, this, that. I still don't see startups at the same scale punching above their weight yet from India. And part of me wonders if, well, there is a lack of incentive because there's too much bureaucracy, or if the ecosystem's not really as, like, the, for a creator, like, there's audience, for a startup, there's customers, and they're not a stable lot. It's a very, like, diverse range that you're sort of, at least when you're B2C. Why do you think are startups not yet where they could be potentially, given how, I'm using a lot of assumptions here, given how smart and whatnot our people are?
It's just a simple factor of the market not being deep enough. The reality is that we are a poor country. We may want to believe that we are not, but we are.
Right.
The wealth is in the hands of very, very, very few. And that is not enough for anyone to make a sizable, meaningful B2C business.
Right.
When you look at B2B, it instantly proves that point, because most of the B2B startups that started in India realized very quickly that the market doesn't exist, but they had the potential and the capability of venturing out and selling to customers outside of India, because it's B2B and doesn't need to be a local customer. And when they began to do that, the success was just brilliant. You know, whether it's Freshworks or it's Zoho or it's Bingify or it's so many other, BrowserStack, and brilliant startups that we may not even know of or would have heard of, that have their foundation and their roots in India. They're selling to customers completely outside. Most people would not even know of them. They're not pop culture names, but they are building businesses that will be, if not the biggest, then one of the biggest names in the software or the SaaS world. B2C is just hard. I think it's just a game of patience. And what's happened, unfortunately, is because India is such a story that has been sold for the last 10 years, for no fault of anyone's, but it's just been a tough country to build. The market's what was never there. The money was there. So the money came in much earlier than the market, which is how it should be. But unfortunately, a lot more money came than what the market needed. So it created intense competition. It created this massive funding that people didn't know any better. So they just ended up spending that money in some way, in hindsight, wasting it, but still not being able to create a big enough entity that made money and that was profitable and growing. But I think as the economy becomes bigger and people have a lot more money, that is inevitably going to change. So it's just a game of patience. I wish it was played slower. And this is just in hindsight. I am just as guilty as anyone else. I played it far faster than I should have as well as an entrepreneur.
Right.
And I think most other founders go through the same. So it's just lack of market.
Is an analog for this situation like what you see with, say, Greater Faridabad, Greater Noida and real estate, where they made too many flats before people were ready to buy? Right. Okay. I see. Correct. So we're all getting the market projection absolutely wrong, huh? From real estate.
Yeah, totally.
But like, you know, help me understand. This is such an interesting thing that I'm thinking about now that you mentioned. Because people raise millions of dollars, man. How do you end up wasting $1 million? Like, what does that look like? What are your expenses like? Champagne? $500,000?
Like, the truth is, the biggest beneficiary of all the venture capital funding has been Google and Facebook.
Right.
They have been the majority, or I would say media in general. So I don't necessarily want to say just Google and Facebook, but also offline media. When you look at the Bennett Coleman Group or any large media houses, whether it's television, whether it's newspaper, whether it's combined, or for sure Google and Facebook, they have been the biggest beneficiaries. Not as much money has gone into people's hand, while there has been considerably in paying salaries and so on. But everyone pays an Amazon tax, which is AWS, and everyone pays a Google or a Facebook tax, which is just the advertising to get customers. And that's where 60-70% of all the funding goes to.
It's kind of unique, huh?
It's like, it is fascinating when you think about this. Like, it's almost, exactly. It's, think about it this way. What if, and I'm just thinking, what if Google and Facebook actually got together one day and said, you know what, we're sitting on fuckloads of cash and we don't really know what's the best return on this because most of the products that we've built haven't really worked. So why don't we actually go about funding the best venture capitals in the world? And then we ask them to go and fund possibly every startup that there is in the world, because we know that 60% of that is going to come back to us. And we will also, of course, strike gold where of all the gazillion investments that are made, a few of them will go on to make remarkable success and earn us the return. So we are going to get 60% of our
money back,
capital money back guaranteed. And then we will have an upside, which is unlimited.
My God.
If I were a Google Facebook executive, I would take that. Of course, I'm assuming that this doesn't happen and it's folklore, but it's a fascinating way of thinking about it.
For sure. Like, you've managed to optimize against risk at like all levels at that. But you know what I think? It's like, how soon before they become identities? You know, like, I see Facebook. Nobody uses Facebook anymore. According to me, I think Facebook's like an ID card. You use it to access every other portal that you want to access, right? And nobody cares, right? But my point is, if you can introduce something like a currency, which is not far using crypto as a tool, you have the loyalty. You have your necessity. In fact, Google, Facebook, and all these companies are more necessary than governments on some level, right? As far as businesses are concerned. You could pretty much like do quite a lot. It's a monstrous amount of power.
Yeah, it is. Right. As we're seeing it already unfold.
For sure. For sure. In your experience as an entrepreneur, like, I'm sure there is a lot of hard skill to be spoken about. You have a course and you speak about how to go through it, which I think is very fascinating, because if I had to go through all the steps, having a blueprint is going to help, right? Like, there's no two ways about the fact that having a blueprint is going to help. I wonder how much of entrepreneurship at the top level is about people management. And I mean that very specifically. Like, if it's 100% of top level entrepreneurship, what percentage of that is just being able to communicate, talk to people, etc., etc., etc.? Soft skills.
In the early days, I would say it'll be close to 100%, because it is the people that are going to ship the product out that will eventually make you survive or not. And if you do a piss poor job of managing your people, you're not going to even exist. So forget everything else. As you move along, it, at least at the top level, if I were say the CEO and the founder, it still never goes, or ideally should never go below 50%. But it does go to that level because other things then take over, and you have to think about market, you have to think about investors, you have to think about relationships, sure, customers, so on. But I'd say it starts with 100% early on, goes, ideally should not go below 50%, and that's where it stays.
Because I wonder how much of an overlap exists between, say, a creator and a founder, at least in terms of operation. World of a difference?
There is a big difference, and I'll tell you what it is now that I've experienced both sides. The creator, by definition, is the creator, which means they have far more jurisdiction and control over the product than anything else. Like if you were to stop working, Prakhar, then there is no product. You are the product. So you essentially have to now figure out where in the world does your product, which is you, fit. That's the journey. You don't need people for that. You just need yourself for that. But a founder is not the product. The founder has to build the product, which is none of the individuals. It is, frankly, a figment of imagination that is lying in someone's head, now has to translate into something which can be touched, felt, experienced. And it is subject to the whims and fancies of whosoever is using it or experiencing it. So it becomes far harder because you're actually creating something that is not in your control and you can't do it on your own. And that's why I feel that, you know, when you look at the world today and you see such fantastic businesses being built by solo founders or solo media founders, and you'd be one of them, maybe I'm one of them, there's several people that we know who are like that. The reason why they are successful is because the world's reached a stage where so much can be done by just one person. And if you then also have the control over the product because you yourself are that product, then the product development cycle is just completely gone and you're not relying on anyone. Now it's just about product market fit, which is 2-3 steps bypassed to straight away get to that point. And that's why it's no surprise that the world today is going to witness a lot more. Like my prediction is in the next 10 to 20 years, the world will see its first unicorn, which is a one-person company.
And you'd think it'd be a media company?
I 100% agree. It could very well be Joe Rogan.
Right. I mean,
He shouldn't have sold.
You think so?
Yeah, totally.
But that's a lot of money, no? 100 million? You can easily see him being tempted.
Absolutely. Yeah, but the thing is, it's like saying, of course, Instagram's selling for $1 billion is a lot of money. But the fact is that Instagram today is perhaps $100 billion.
Oh my God.
So what's more money? $1 billion in 2010 or $100 billion in 2020?
Think about you and I, right? I mean, you for sure have seen millions of dollars move around. I have not. I'm sure Rogan's seen some amount of money move around. But somebody comes up to you and they're like, listen, in 2020, you can get $100 million. $100 million. That's a lot of money. And you're sitting there, you're like, huh, I don't know what it's going to look like in 2025. Because the problem with being a media founder, or for that matter, like, you know, you being your product, is when you stop working, the work stops. And with a company, on the other hand, it's not that way, right? Your company still exists, even though you probably are not heading the whole operation anymore. And so it's probably like, maybe this is time to cash out. Like, how do you decide when it's time to cash out on your bet?
No, exactly the way that you described it. I would any day cash out if I am abstracted from the product. Because then I know that this money is for the work that I have done, not with the work that I will do.
Deep.
Now, Joe, what he's done, and I don't know the final details, so all of this is speculation.
Right.
But what he's done is he said, hey, Spotify, you've given me $100 million check, which is brilliant. But now you've made me sign all these things that will not ever allow Joe Rogan to stop for the next 10 years.
Hmm.
He has to now play the role of Joe Rogan for the next 10 years. So it's not that they're paying him for what he's done and saying, you know what, Joe, there's like a 1 year contract. And after the year, you're free to do whatever else you want to do in life. Thank you so much for building this product. It's like, thank you for working so hard to get to this point. Now for the next 10 years, we're going to milk the shit out of you.
Mm.
And here's $100 million advance for that.
Mm.
So why would I do that? Because now I'm just giving away my freedom, whatever is it that I could have done and so on. And I'm certain, as you said, he was generating an income stream, which was more than enough.
Mm.
He gets his $100 million, but it's not that he can take the $100 million and tell Spotify,
to walk off.
I'm feeling bored of doing this now. Right. I don't want to do this anymore. Like, no more podcasts, please. I'm so done with that.
Right.
He can't do that.
Mm. I feel like, particularly in my case, probably I'm the kind of individual, I desire my creative freedom over everything else. Like, nobody tells me in terms of, if I have to, this is what you want to ask us in a podcast, or this is what you want to say in a speech when you're doing it with us. I'm like, absolutely not, right? My ability to say no is my biggest strength, my biggest asset. At least that's what I try to cultivate. A life where I can say no without feeling bad about it or without being shackled about it. And I'm sure you felt sort of a similar transition, because after a certain while, when the product's abstracted away from you, you came to a place where saying no was easier. You move, and then you later moved on from being an entrepreneur to being a creator. At 35, you became a creator, right?
I became a creator at 35, but I stepped down from my startup at 39.
At 39. So you were playing parallel roles for a while.
Yeah, exactly.
What do you prefer? You prefer creator or you prefer entrepreneur? Or like product entrepreneur?
No, definitely the creator, yeah. The creator, because of the same things that you just stated. There is a lot more control, a lot more clarity, a lot more alignment in what I do to who I am as a person. Product building and startups was fascinating. I would do it all over again if I had to. But what I didn't enjoy, and this was just my doing, it wasn't something that was imposed on me. What I didn't enjoy was the entire fundraising process. What I didn't enjoy was the entire go out and create more and more valuation for the company, because that's the only thing that works. I wish that I had the foresight to see through all of that when it was happening and be a lot wiser about the decisions that I made, particularly about how fast we should be growing and why. I would have loved to build this slow. Because that's who I inherently am. I'm a very, very patient person. So I was doing something which was not, like, I was playing a game where the rules were not set by. That meant I was meant to lose.
Right. There is an implicit arm twisting that the ecosystem creates, right? Like, where you have to play by its unsaid rules otherwise, right? And it's even to the world, if it might not be unfree, to the soul and to the soul of a creative person, it's absolutely unfree, and it just doesn't sit well. You know, it's funny, like, how many years since that particular incident happened, and you reflect on it with such emotion still, that must mean that it was valuable, it was insightful, and that taught you for the rest of however many years of your life. And frankly, I did not even get to dig deep today. We are 55 minutes and we have 5 more minutes. I did not even get to dig deep today because so many questions I still have, and I've thoroughly enjoyed. I don't know if you noticed, I was in my question game. Like, I was all like, give me information. I want to know. I want to learn. There's so much to do that. But thank you so much, Ankur, for doing this. Do you have any questions for me?
I'd love to know what drives you to create content. Yeah, what do you think is your motivation? Why do you do what you do? Because that's my question that I ask everyone.
Dude, I fell in love with university 4 months into being. So I was studying to be a CA, right? Hated it. Finally finagled my way somehow to get to a great university. I go to Columbia. I stepped in first semester. I was blank as a slate. I didn't know what was happening. I was awestruck and thunderstruck and just like unconfident and all that. And then within a year or so, I felt more myself and I fell in love instantly. And what I wanted at that point, I realized two things, one about myself, one about the nature of how I want my life to be. About myself, I am giftedly curious, and I don't think that's particularly the best gift to have, but it's mine and I love it. The second thing is, I would rather be the less smart person in the room. because I'd get to learn more and then maybe find a way to distribute it to somebody along the way if it's useful for them. But I just, it's like, I love ideas. Ideas are my thing. Concepts, abstractions are my thing. So around the two year mark, I decided I'll start a podcast, and I started this. PG Radio started sometime in 2019. And well, for the first however many months, it did not do well. And even now, it certainly does what it does, but I could have created it to be more massy from the get. And I don't regret it. I love what it is now because this is my soul. And so what I realized after that was that I needed, say, a vertical integration to reach to the masses. And I created Prakhar Ke Pravachan. Since then, both of these have shaped and evolved in their own ways. But at best, why I love doing what I love doing is, one, the element of exploration. Even when I'm speaking by myself, it is me in active thought. I'm legitimately walking a tightrope where I'm trying to describe an idea as it occurs to me in my head. I'm trying to finagle all the ends of a possible, you know, network. And so that I love doing. It's a private practice ground I have. And I see that the ultimate stage is going to be something else eventually. So YouTube's not really an end in itself for me at all, by any means. And then two is because it allows me to continue my educative process, right? Like for some of the things that I have to talk about on Prakhar Ke Pravachan, I have to go out and then Google and figure and synthesize and analyze. Yeah. Here, I am absolutely the asker of questions and the absorber of knowledge. So it helps me like that. And and at best, I think it's the level of freedom I get, because I've always been somebody who's just not comfortable with being told what to do. This is just my sin. This is my original sin. I work with it. And so, you know, it all comes together very nicely along a central axis that is closer to my heart and soul than almost anything else is. And so this works for now. And I started doing all of this primarily during the lockdown. As soon as they announced it, I was like, my investment needs to go somewhere else, not with university. I'd rather be on Zoom on the other side than be on Zoom on this side. And that's when I started pushing heavy on it. And within a year, it's closing in on a year, it's changed my life entirely. It's changed my personality entirely. It's changed almost everything about me piece by piece. The ship of thesis is complete like that. And so that's been the journey. I'm still to realize what is to come. I'm very fond of taking it by the day. But
very nice. I love that. No, that's the best way to do it. Yeah, absolutely. You just set yourself on a habit and let the habit take you to goals.
Sure, bottom up building up, right? Totally, instead of a teleological. But Ankur, thank you so much for doing this. If you ever have time, I'll ask you again. Let's do this more often. I had so much fun doing this with you.
Let's totally do that, man. Thank you so much for being super inquisitive and asking me very thoughtful questions. It was a joy, brother.
I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Streams ended.